Yes, this is a Mark Haney Show on a mission to ignite the entrepreneurial revolution right here in the hometown we love. And that starts with entrepreneurs. But entrepreneurs, they need capital, right? They need more than capital. They need to build a great team. They need capital. They need to be solving a big problem. Today on the show, we're going to be bringing on Marcos Fernandez. He is a venture capitalist. He is the co-founder of Fiat Ventures. They invest into early stage fintech companies. He's a Sacramento guy. He went out and had some success in the high tech industry with companies that you have heard of before. He was an early employee in Ripple and SoFi and others. And today he shares the story of turning early stage fintech employee into early stage fintech investor. So Marcos is going to share his story. And Marcos, you'll hear us on the show. He brings me a little gift, and he hands it to me in the middle of the show, and it makes an impact on me. It was specially picked out. He did a little research. He found out my Cabo nickname, and which is Margarita Mark, and he brings me a special gift that hits home for me. And at the end of the show today, I'm going to talk a little bit about that. Not just gifts, but gifts and effort and things that we do in our life that make an impact, that don't just don't just do it. You do it great. You do it in a way that's going to be memorable. I'm going to share a little bit about that at the end of the show, because there's no question, Marcos, he makes an impact on me. He made an impact I think all of us during the show. So anyway, stick around, my friends. Enjoy the story of Marcos Fernandez, the co-founder of Fiat Ventures. Okay, we are recording. And now I'm here with Marcos Fernandez. He is the managing partner at Fiat Ventures. We're going to talk today a little bit about venture capital. We're going to talk a little bit about startups. We're going to talk a little bit about tequila. You brought me a bottle of tequila. Is there anything else we want to talk about today, Marcos?
That covers it. Okay. I think that's a pretty good track.
I love it. Yeah. Well, you, Fiat Ventures, you guys are known for investing into fintech companies. If you don't mind, could you give me a little bit of your background and your journey to venture capital?
Yeah, definitely. Was fortunate coming out of business school and getting an MBA from UT Austin to, I'd like to tell you it was planned out, but got really lucky in knowing someone from my class to land at SoFi, which has since gone public and been seen as a pretty big fintech. And at that time was, 70 people in one room trying to build fast and furiously. And I found myself there as an intern doing everything from putting together these massive podcast campaigns when it was really early to commercials to filling 15 balloons for a photo shoot.
Okay, so you're one of the first employees there.
I was one of the first, and I was squarely at the bottom of the totem pole, right? I was a summer intern who was I will literally do anything to get this. And I saw something really special there of just the unbundling of financial services and the ability to build a digital bank, which at the time, Chime wasn't even around yet, is really early days. And so I kind of grasped onto that, right? And kind of fast forward, I was lucky to be there after I graduated and to work while I was still in school and came in to lead go-to-market strategy. So got to launch a whole bunch of products, everything after their first one. So personal credit solutions, robo-advising solutions, insurtech solutions, and even building the foundations for what has become the digital bank that they're just officially licensed to get. And small part of a very, very big team, but it was amazing to be riding shotgun there. And shortly after that, I was thinking about what comes next is becoming bigger. I like the fast-paced opportunities, and I had the opportunity to join Ripple, which is cross-border payments company, but really squarely focused in the cryptocurrency space. And this was mid-2017. I'd been following Bitcoin for a while then, and same kind of thing, right? 100 people, couple offices at that point, but really scrappy, fast-growing, and was fortunate to lead go-to-market for one product, ended up leading business development for that product, and then all of the products across the Americas and launching into EMEA and Southeast Asia, and just got this really wonderful experience. But outside of my day job, I was spending all my time advising and investing in early stage companies and not writing massive checks, but getting some skin in the game. And I'd come out of these meetings with entrepreneurs, say during a lunch break or a coffee break, on just such a high. Like, I was just like, this is what I love doing. And my day job is really to support access to meet all these wonderful individuals. But really, it's this, what I want to do. Like, this is, I feel this inkling. So I was really fortunate, you know, about a year ago, a couple of my really good buddies and now business partners who I've known for a while, they started what has become, you know, the premier growth shop in the fintech space. They're thinking about starting a VC, and I was talking to them, you know, thinking about what's next and saying, you know, my real passion is to be a full-time venture capitalist advising and investing in companies. And, you know, they're like, that's really funny because we're thinking about raising a fund because we have all this amazing access, but we just don't have time to build it. And so the stars aligned and we've been kind of off to the races ever since.
Well, that's amazing. You've had such a trajectory, right? You're a Sacramento. Well, you moved here, went to Oak Ridge High School. Mm-hmm. Then you went out to seek your fortune, so to speak. And you got involved in some tech companies that have blown up in the fintech space. And are you 33 years old? How old are you?
34.
Oh, you're getting old. 20. You're aging.
Yeah. I tell people maybe.
But
that's
30. Amazing. Managing partner of a venture fund at that age. I mean, what do your parents say? We were talking about your parents coming out to visit your child the other day, and your baby boy, and they got to be so proud of you.
I can't speak for them. I try to do them well. You know, it was my dad. We were out visiting them in Arizona towards the end of my PAT leave, and I had the opportunity to lead a couple really great companies in both crypto and in fintech, and lead kind of their BD initiatives throughout the U.S. and Americas. And then I had this opportunity to really kind of kickstart and be more entrepreneurial and start this VC fund. And I was out with my dad one day and we were kind of talking through it, and he was just kind of looked at me. He was like, you know, Marcos, it's about time you take the training wheels off. And I was like, that's
okay,
in only a way that a dad can, right? Where I was like, that's amazing. And he was right. Is, you know, like, don't take the safe route this time. I think it's time to, you know, jump out and do it.
Yeah. Well, it's exciting. I think it's great for Sacramento. We need to help more startups. Now as a, so I'm an emerging venture cap. I'm a startup venture capitalist as well, but I'm a heck of a lot older. Maybe we can compare notes a little bit. Okay,
absolutely.
So you're investing into fintech companies. Yeah. I'm invested into, my focus is Sacramento regional companies, startups that can scale. Mm-hmm. How do you go about choosing the fintech companies?
Yeah, great question. In the early stages, you always know, as and I'm literally preaching to the choir here, is, you know, companies are going to shift. Their go-to-market strategies of the first products you launch is going to be very different than where you end up. And this has been proven time and time again, right? Instagram started as like an app for sharing liquors, right? And Chime started as a rewards app that then turned into a digital bank. It happens over and over. So we try to over-index on two things, right? One is team. Right? Is this a founding team who's either done this before, or has a ton of conviction, or what we call like founder market fit? Like, what gives them the sense of wanting to do this, and what previous experiences get them there?
Founder market fit. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. And then two is total addressable market, or TAM. Mm-hmm. So is this market big enough to house multiple winners? Is there a lot of competition in this space already? Are they first to market? If it's a smaller market, are they the first mover? What is their advantage, right? Like, how easy is it for others to replicate this? All of those types of questions. And once you have an idea of those two, everything else is important, but can become secondary, because if you have a team that knows how to be quick and nimble and they know this market from past experiences, maybe the product they have today is different than what actually takes off, but you have the conviction that they can run through walls and know the right walls to run through to be able to get there and ultimately create these outsized companies and ultimately, you know, building the next disruptive, you know, tech.
Well, your broader group helps companies to grow. That's part of your expertise. And I remember talking to you about maybe even a specialty within the direct-to-consumer space. So in terms of your focus as a venture capitalist, do you narrow it down? How do you narrow down fintech?
Yeah, it's tough. Okay. And it's something that myself and my two other general partners, Drew and Alex, we talk about it constantly. And it's really good discussions around what is fintech, because it's becoming so broad and you're starting to see the emergence of fintech bleeding into almost every sector,
you
right?
Bet.
Google has become a fintech. Mm-hmm. Apple has become a fintech. So where do you draw the line? And The truth is that we try to keep it as wide as possible because we don't just want to invest in what is known in fintech today, but also in what we see emerging and becoming fintech tomorrow. Examples of that are as it spills into healthcare or e-commerce. We make a lot of investments and look at a lot of embedded finance, so solutions that allow others to be able to become fintechs more easily.
Okay.
But it's tough, right? You want to make sure that you're investing in things that align to your thesis, but also you don't want to miss out on an opportunity because you're too narrow-minded. So,
is there an example of one that you're really proud of?
Yes. There always are. I always preface this question with, we love all of our kids equally. And it's the truth, right? As you know, right? You wouldn't have brought them into Growth Factor or invested unless you had a ton of conviction behind what they're doing. So the one that stands out right now is we actually just signed a term sheet to lead their Series A. It's Copper Banking, a teen bank based out of Seattle. And
teen bank.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's this emerging group that we're seeing. There's a couple other in the space, but you know, I remember when I was a kid and my parents wanted to teach me about financial literacy, we walked into a Wells Fargo, we opened up an account for me, and then they had some parameters around it, but there's nothing built for it. Well, what's happening today, especially as kids are becoming, you know, more financially savvy, as well as just being better at, you know, using technology, there's these teen-first banks that really give the tools to parents to not just give their kids access to finances, but to help spur this conversation around financial literacy. So it gives parents the comfort of knowing that they have guardrails in place to track different spending habits, but it gives the kids the power to start learning about financial literacy. How do you build a budget? How do you spend responsibly? Wow. How do you track this? And do so through dedicated debit cards, dedicated apps that also kind of spurs conversations. So pop-ups around different topics to try to help just promote financial literacy within the teen space.
Well, that's really interesting. Now, you said you're going to lead them on their Series A. Maybe you can just sort of define that for our audience. What does that mean? So you're an early stage investor. I invest into companies that are, some of them are pre-revenue, others have revenue, some are maybe going for their Series A, but maybe you can kind of walk through that stage a little bit and maybe what the Series A consists of.
Yeah, great question. So Series A is still seen as early stage, and I'll walk the audience real quick. Typically, you see a pre-seed, which is the first amount of capital. A lot of times, that's family and friends or bootstrapped by entrepreneurs who have some money from past ventures. Into a seed is typically the first time they take on capital from outside investors. That seed can accelerate into a seed extension or a Series A, and that's really seen as the first time that you're putting in meaningful capital. After that, you'll hear terms alphabetically, right? A, B, C, D, E, F. Generally, anything from pre-seed to A is seen as early stage, just higher upside for the economics that you get from these investments, but higher risk because it's earlier stage, they're figuring it out. And then growth stage starts at Series B, really accelerated until there's a public offering or an exit.
So you're investing in these different stages, and the valuations are different. An A, the valuation is a lot lower than a B or a C. So what is there a range there that you look at in terms of valuation for a Series A?
Yeah, definitely. And it's different between markets. It's different between products. So a Series A of someone who's bootstrapped this for 4 years is going to look different than someone who, you know, has done this only for a year. A Series A of an enterprise technology company is different than someone who's building, you know, another digital credit saving app. But okay. Typically what you're looking for is, you know, total market of where they are, some early signs of revenue and product market fit in an A. You're also looking at comparables around the market, but as you know, things are pretty frothy. So we like to look more at revenue run rates and conviction behind founders. This one, we were lucky. We've been working with them since September of 2020, and that's given us, you know, a year and a half of opportunities to do due diligence.
But is this your first investment into the company right now, or did you make a prior investment?
We made a seed investment in them as well. Yeah, so we invested in their last round. That was led by Pioneer Square Ventures, a firm out of Seattle as well.
And now they chose you to lead this one. Is that how that worked?
In short, it is. There's different ways that entrepreneurs can either choose or think about how they want to raise capital. In this one, we're really lucky. There's a lot of venture capital funds who are preempting this round just because it's a really exciting company with a lot of growth. They were originally going to raise in April. Because of our relationships, we're lucky to really work with the team and lean in with them. And ultimately, you know, their goal is to raise a Series A, continue their really exponential growth and then go out and raise a Series B towards the end of the year.
So they're a bank. They have all the charters and all the different things associated with being a bank all lined up, and they have deposits on hand?
Yeah, great question. So they themselves aren't necessarily a bank.
Okay.
They work with sponsor banks who provide access to all of this. Now, they are regulated and licensed, but what's interesting is in the United States, it's really difficult to get new banking license.
Right.
So there's these really cool, creative, fintech-friendly banks like the Evolve Banks of the world and the Cross River Banks, who they themselves are providing easier ways for fintechs to build on top of their existing licenses and ultimately access to local payments rails. So, yeah.
Well, you mentioned SoFi, and they were in the news recently. You mentioned that they became a bank. They bought a local bank, Golden Pacific Bank, which is kind of interesting, right? They're based out of the Bay Area, right, SoFi?
They are, yes.
Yeah, they're based out of the Bay Area. They come in and they buy a local small independent bank, and what do you know?
Yeah,
they become a bank.
Yeah, it's interesting, right? Because it's so difficult to get accepted, which they eventually did. Sometimes it's easier to buy people who have those existing licenses and roll them in, but there's still challenges with regulation to make sure that people can approve that taking place. And I can't speak much to that acquisition. I was long gone by the time they did it, but I know that we've been or had been working on that type of thing since, you know, 2016. So it'll show you just how long it can take to actually get approvals from regulators in certain cases.
Well, let's talk about raising the fund. As an entrepreneur, this is your first fund. You have to go raise money, and so you're using other people's money to go invest into these companies. There's this huge amount of responsibility associated with managing other people's money. I feel that as well. But it's interesting because when you're trying to make these, when you're making investments while you're raising a fund, which is what we're doing as well, It's like flying the airplane and building the airplane at the same time. What's the toughest part of the job?
Yeah, great point, great analogy. It truly is. All of that being said, the toughest part of the job for me by far is when you get to know an entrepreneur really well, you get to understand their business, and for some reason or other, you can't invest. Fundraising's tough. It's like you said, it's a slog. You're working on it, but to this day, you know, like entrepreneurs are really the rock stars. I like to consider ourselves the roadies who are setting up the stage for them, but ultimately like I'm not playing the instruments. They truly are. And when you meet someone incredibly smart and talented and passionate, right, who are putting their entire life, their savings, their time behind something, and for some reason or other, you're not able to invest into it. The best entrepreneurs get it. They know it. They understand it. But it's still really, really tough. What we try to do is to be honest and transparent, but you don't want to, you know, break someone's heart if it's something that is kind of fundamental to their business. But what we found is that it's best to be honest with it. You know, the way that we're set up at our company and fund on the consulting side and fund side, I'm really managing a lot of the VC side. So that my other two partners can focus on building pipeline and helping with things like investments, but it tends to make me bad cop. So I am the guy who, you know, 95% of the time has these conversations, and it never gets easier to have them. So I know it's a long-winded answer for a simple question, but that's the toughest
interesting.
Part.
So I coached a little bit of sports in my day, and occasionally you have too many players trying out for very few spots, and so you end up having to make the cuts. And I mean, it can be gut-wrenching. It can be gut-wrenching for high school sports, youth sports. These are tough tough dreams to derail a little bit. But when you're talking about people's business, I have to imagine it's more than that. So you just call them up on the phone and tell them sorry. What do you say? You said be honest. Well, like your product sucks. What do you say? Or like I didn't like you. What about if it's like, look, I know your passion. I know you love your product, but look, I just am not feeling the chemistry, man or lady.
Luckily, it's really that, and you know. Good entrepreneurs understand this the way this, like you and I with our fundraising efforts, right? We're not over dependent on any particular investor because we've built up such a deep pipeline of conversations, and it's just a name. Mm-hmm. It's the name of the game. Like, thank you for your time. We appreciate it. Let's keep in touch. We'll let you know how we're doing, maybe future funds or future rounds.
You bet.
But with that, right, usually what we tend to do is, or what I tend to do is just be very honest. In some cases, has to do with the economics, right? Like, listen, you're raising a seed extension. The valuation is really high. We haven't worked with you for very long, so we just can't get there today. Oftentimes we'll invest in companies who we have some sort of relationship with. So sometimes it's, listen, we'd love to really lean in a future round, but we just don't know your business. In some cases it's internal factors, right? Maybe we just made a couple really big commitments and we're coming up on another close. So quite frankly, we're just kind of tapped out, and the timeline for what you need this for is too quick. And
We have a bad cop too at the Growth Factory. His name's Rick Spencer. He's sitting right over there. To come into the Growth Factory, we had a lot of applicants, and so we had to narrow it down. There ended up being an interview process, and ultimately we did invest into rock stars, but the part of you're not ready yet sometimes is where it's at. Other times it's just not really a great fit. What about when you say yes? How does, is there a celebration? Well, I mean, it's early to celebrate too much when you're making your investment, but when anybody who's gone out to raise money knows that when you go start, it starts happening. I mean, you are high fiving, you are fired up, especially when you get a nice big influx of capital from a venture capitalist.
Yep.
I mean, there's gotta be some sort of, onboarding celebration or something.
Yeah. I mean, that's the best part. What's funny is I usually give the bad news. We share the good news, right? So if Alex or Drew bring in a really exciting deal and we go through our diligence and it ends up happening, like, I want them to have those moments too. So it's great, right? We call them up, we'll text them, we'll be like, we're appreciative. Thank you for letting us lean in. This is why we like it. But quite frankly, we're also say, these are the things we'd like to work with you on. Like, these are the things that may have paused us or in areas. And oftentimes, again, good entrepreneurs know where their gaps are, so they're going to call them out, and they'll even have strategies of how to fill them. So very real conversations there. And then what we end up doing is we will send like a little gift or a little note or in a handwritten letter, which you don't get handwritten letters very much, to just kind of welcome them into the family and just let them know we are always here for you and this is how we can work together.
Do you ever give them tequila?
No,
because you brought me. Okay, Marcos, I'm holding. If you watch it on YouTube, you see this really cool bottle of tequila. Apparently there's a rumor going around that I'm like Margarita Mark when I'm not here at the office, but I really appreciate that. And
of course I
think that is, it's interesting that that you take such, I had no idea. Occasionally people will bring a gift, but it's not very often. And for you to learn some of my bad habits, my fun habits, is interesting that you took that personalization to a podcast. So I appreciate that very much.
Of course.
Also appreciate you came out and you spoke to our founders as they're going through our boot camp, this first cohort. They were all ears when you began coaching and presenting to them. So when you're coaching a startup, I mean, you have so much to offer. Go-to-market strategies, I know, are a big part of what you're doing, but you were helping our people with how to present. What do you see as like the biggest gaps that startups need to get filled?
Yeah, definitely, and appreciate the opportunity to do so. The companies that you have in the Growth Factory, I get so impressed by the founders. I won't drop specific names because there's too many to go through, but it just happens over and over. So thanks for letting me be a part of that. And the biggest things for founders, right? The most precious resource most people think is the money that you have in capital, but it actually in those early stages is your time. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, all of us only have 24 hours in the day, and so we have to be really careful about how we use those. And oftentimes, founders have a lack of focus, right? They spend too much time focusing on the people who don't want their product as opposed to the people that do and hyper-focusing on how to build that out. They'll spend too much time trying to go after too many people with too many products and too many features, as opposed to understanding what is that one product and that one user base that has that absolute need for it, and you are solving the problem that's keeping them up at night. And so that's one of the big themes, right, is people are trying to be too much for too many people. And sure, it's good to sell a vision of where you want this thing to be in 5 years, but you have to also convince people, especially in the early stages, that you're going to be here in a year with a very particular thing, and that's your wedge to break into it.
Yeah. What about the reluctancy of some founders to bring in the best possible leadership team around them, the founder that says, look, I'm kind of the guy or the gal. And look, I'm going to try to do it with people who are a little less up to co-founder level. Yeah. Do you invest into companies that have only one founder? Or is it always the founding team?
Short answer is yes, but it has to be a very particular type of founder, and you're spot on, right? Is we don't invest into companies where founders think that they can solve everything or want to take on too much. We don't invest into companies where founders can't give us an answer of their gaps or their blind spots. And that's a question we ask is, what's keeping you up at night? Where are your biggest gaps? How are you going to fill that? And the answer we like to hear is, I have this problem, this problem, this problem, this problem. I've solved that by hiring this person and this person, but I'm still looking for this and this.
Okay.
And what we've seen from really these massive successes, again, back to like the Chimes and the SoFis, the Brexes, the companies that we've been able to work alongside who have really taken off, it's founders who know they have gaps and that they have the ability to recruit and retain the best employees to fill those gaps, and that they know they're not the smartest person on every topic. And in fact, I'll be the first to admit it, I will tell you, I'm not the smartest person in really any room, but the goal is to try to surround yourself with people who are much more talented and bright and can offer a lot more.
Yeah, it's interesting. You mentioned the word rock stars. When you invest into a rock star, these are people that, you know, one might be a little more country, one might be a little more rock and roll, but they all have one thing in common. Rock stars can get people to want to get up and move around a little bit.
Yep.
And people are always asking, you know, how do I go get these people? And a lot of it has to do with the founder and maybe the other early co-founding team. And are they really rock stars? Can they really, I guess, convince others? Are they doing something important enough for others to get in the car with them, to get on board?
Yeah.
Because we know as a founder, you know, these early stage companies, they can't write big salary type checks. And, right. You know, it has to come, the satisfaction has to come in different ways.
Absolutely, right. The biggest way, at least early on, is equity, right? Mm-hmm. Like that, getting people convinced and being smart about how you're allocating equity, how you're thinking about those types of grants. Even the best founders and teams, they're able to attract really smart people in some sort of advisory capacity. Oftentimes those early advisors turn into employees after you get through a Series A or B round when you can think about bigger salaries.
Got a little
salaries.
Bit more money to pay them, yeah.
Absolutely. And one of the biggest things we look for in founders is the ability to fundraise, right? The unfortunate reality, and not in every company, there are so many successful companies that don't have to take in outside capital, but these outsized companies, because these markets are a foot race. Like if you're not there first in building for scale, someone else is going to do that before you. So when we look for these, you know, multi-billion dollar opportunities, we're looking at someone who can fundraise, because you can fundraise your way through a lot of problems by hiring the right people around you. So it's this combination of being able to attract and retain talent with the ability to fundraise so that you can have capital to be able to hire those rock stars.
You know, it's interesting because talking to founders over the years, talked to probably thousands of them just coming up through the office and a little session like this, a Hanging with Haney session. The majority of the founders, the people that the visionaries behind the business, they really tend to be product type people on average, which doesn't make you extremely charismatic. It doesn't make you have financial literacy, you know, but you know your product and you might not even know the market that well. Do you see that same type of thing? And how do you test for financial literacy or the ability to go out and fundraise? Because if you don't know the difference between a balance sheet and an income statement, you need some training before you get out there and start talking numbers with people.
Yeah, definitely. It all goes back to, and we all know a lot of times it's the engineers and product minded folks who build the best companies, because they're always thinking so detail orientedly and can roll up their sleeves and build these incredible, particularly software based companies. But it's the ones who know that they have gaps, right? So the ones who understand, like, I need to get better at fundraising. And for example, we work with one entrepreneur right now. He's very soft-spoken, very methodical. He's a product-minded guy who was formerly an engineer, and he's one of the best fundraisers I've ever met, because it's not always about going out and having like this massive, you know, dog and pony show and being the world's best salesperson. It's really about having the ability to get people behind your story and your vision. And so it doesn't always have to be like, you know, really loud and shiny charts. It can just be a very well thought out, articulated statement. We see that there's another one, amazing female entrepreneur who we're getting ready to do another co-investment in her Series C. This is Lily Bank. Her name is Lilac. Again, very, you know, well-spoken individual, but also someone who has done this before so much that she knows how to tell a story and wrap people around it. So over time, I think founders learn what that is. They understand what the market's missing. How can you position yourselves as being the one to fit it? Some of the best ones know whatever buzzword it is at the time that gets people excited to be able to just draw attention. And their goal, right, is to just raise capital. Obviously, you want to build to what you're saying you are, but they also know how to weave that story to fit the gaps that are out there.
You said Lily Bank. Is that the name of the company?
That's right. Yeah,
okay,
L-I-L-I.
So that's two banks.
It is.
So when you look at this landscape, let's talk about fintech, if you don't mind, the product piece and the type
Absolutely.
Of opportunities that you see emerging. So obviously, banking as we know it is changing right before our very eyes. Maybe let's talk about the banking sector and how you see it changing, and then maybe we can move to some other things within fintech that you see as like emerging and really interesting.
Yeah, love this, and I know we don't have all day, but feel like I could talk about this all day. It's an exciting time for fintech as a whole. We've seen a lot of innovation, but it feels like we're still just getting started. So to the banking question in particular, and Rick and I were just talking about this a little bit, is we're starting to see the emergence not just of the SoFi and Chimes who are catering to large, broad audiences, but companies who are catering towards a very particular either demographic or type of consumer. So Lily focuses on freelancers, right? So 1099 employees specifically. Copper focuses on teens. We also work with a company called Daylight that focuses on the LGBTQ+ community by providing services within that organization. Another one called Greenwood, which is a really big one out of Atlanta that focuses on the African-American community. First Boulevard's another example mm-hmm. there. And the reason why these opportunities get us really excited is at the end of the day, all roads lead to lending. And this is the same with traditional banks, right? Wells Fargo, Citi, JP Morgan, Chase, all of their services were loss leaders, right? Their payment services and their banking services to ultimately provide to you lending solutions, credit cards, home mortgages, auto loans. So now we're seeing this really cool trend of the emergence of embedded finance. So these companies that make it easier to plug in a lending solution into your platform and white label that, mixed with the ability to get eyeballs and in particular affinity groups and demographics, creating ultimately an easier way to get lifetime value.
Okay.
So quick example for you. 10 years ago, if I wanted to start a mortgage lender, I would have to go out and get broker licenses, work with a whole bunch of people throughout the stack through a very paper and manual intensive process. Today, it's getting as easy as integrating an API and getting that into my system and white labeling it.
So you could take an existing business with, it could be a digital business with a lot of users, and then within their transactions, you basically create a lending opportunity.
That's right. And okay. A lot of it, you have to be really authentic, right? You don't want it to seem like, hey, look at this product and this product. But the way that they start typically are, here's a banking solution for you. Here's a debit card and a savings account with some lending credit facilities associated, but really just this is kind of for us by us. Like this is for a very particular need that you have within these different demographics, and also building good community programs around it. So it feels like the money that you're putting behind it goes towards these either social causes, demographic causes, aspirations, another one towards like eco-friendly initiatives. But really what's exciting there is as they build out more and more users, they'll be able to integrate these other solutions more seamlessly through their platform. And it's not, obviously, like money drives a lot of decisions, but there's also ways that then you can start controlling the flow of funds and really building out these ways to give back to those local communities. So the Daylight example, again, they've got this card, but what they're also doing is if there's certain LGBTQ+ restaurants or services in a particular area, they actually give you extra cash back and donate some of that back to those local businesses. So it really mm-hmm. does create this kind of community feeling. And from that, right, to embedded finance, as they think about other services they want to offer, it just makes it easier for you to do your entire financial services with one of these neobanks.
Yeah, well, it's interesting to think about, you know, there's already consolidation within the banking industry, right? But banks sort of gobbling up other banks.
Mm-hmm.
But what does that mean for the brick and mortar banks of the future? Are we going to see less and less brick and mortar?
Short answer is yes. And it was really spurred by the pandemic. So Plaid always comes out with these amazing reports around just financial services. And If there's one thing, well, there's many things that this global pandemic has caused, but one of them is just the emergence of people feeling more comfortable doing their finances through digital platforms. Before, a lot of people had already started doing it, but when all of a sudden I can't leave my house to go to that branch, or I can't go to this particular location, it makes me as a consumer more comfortable doing finances through apps, through online portals. And so short answer is yes. Now, some of the best community banks that we have seen, and obviously there's always good ones in different regions, so the dynamics are different, are ones who have adopted these types of digital platforms. So there's actually fintechs out there focused on community banks that help them roll out apps more easily, or mm-hmm. help them tap into other products so that they can add lending to their books. But the long and short of it is there will always need to be a presence for brick and mortar, almost kind of like, why would someone want to have a store on Miracle Mile in Chicago? To have a presence, especially in major areas, but over time, it's just become such a big overhead that a lot of it will continue to become more digitized.
What about crypto and all the different people that are, you know, investing in a Bitcoin and trying to pay with Bitcoin? It's obviously growing. It's a buzz. These are, you know, kind of like some of the hottest stuff. If you turn on CNBC, you know, they're talking about the price of Bitcoin. Are you investing into companies in and around that space?
In short, absolutely.
Yeah.
And for folks who can't see, I've got a big smile on my face because I love talking about this too. It's a sector. I'll kind of take a quick walk with you, but at a high level, digital assets and the digitization of money and these different types of ways to associate trust with each other, it's going to continue to revolutionize the way that we do everything. And it's been about, you know, a little over a decade since it first emerged, but the implications are really starting to take hold now and will continue to over time, really impacting the overall even infrastructure of how we're building solutions. And it's a really exciting time. For us, as an individual, I was lucky to really kind of get to know Bitcoin in 2014 and then to work with Ripple and to get to know the industry. As an individual, I'll invest in different types of tokens and companies that will have different token aspects. As a venture capital fund, we like to invest more in the picks and shovel companies. So not necessarily in the veins themselves. We're in gold country, so we're not buying plots of lands for the actual gold, but for people who are building the shovels and the genes and all of those things, who are helping support from an infrastructure perspective, this emergence. And then the other area that we're investing a lot of money and time into is the collision of traditional fintech with cryptocurrencies. And so what I mean by that are these digital first platforms and digital bank type products that allow it consumers to more easily get access to a lot of the benefits of decentralized finance and these things. So higher yield, so just getting better returns on your investments, easier access to different types of tokens and the way that you store them and keep them. We're really starting to see this collision even between those two sectors, and we see a lot of opportunities there.
So, you know, these emerging industries, like what crypto is today, some people might be thinking, is it too early? Who picking the winners at this stage of the game? It's early.
It's early.
How do you know where to go on something like that? I guess the picks and shovels, is that a de-risked sort of way of going about it?
I'd like to say yes. Time will tell. And
less risk, I guess.
Yeah, chances are sometimes no, right?
Like, okay.
You never know how the market's going to change. I will tell you, I'm really bad at picking individual winners, so I never like to tell people what I think is going to happen. Even when I was at Ripple, it's funny, people would say like, hey, should I buy, you know, XRP? Like, I saw that this, and I was like, I have no idea. If I knew the answer to that, I wouldn't be working at Ripple. You know, I'd be somewhere else. So short answer is, I think everyone should own cryptocurrencies. The best way to start is Bitcoin, and you don't have to buy a lot. Buy $10 worth. See what it's like. Yeah. Get to know the technologies. For anyone who's looking to take a position, I always tell them, you know, weighted cost averaging is your best friend. Buy a little bit over an extended time period because it's a volatile asset, and no one knows how to time the market. We've learned that time and time again.
What's amazing, because we're recording this probably a week or two before the show plays. So, but Bitcoin has dropped in value or dropped in price sort of recently after this kind of enormous run up. Mm-hmm. So some people are seeing this as a buying opportunity today. But it's such a volatile type of product.
It is. And that's all back to any asset, right? Say you've, for simplicity, 100% of your net worth equals $100, for example's sake. No one should really put anything more than, you know, 15% or to 20% of any of that into one particular thing. Yeah. So what I tell people is, and again, this is not financial advice.
Yeah. By the way, yes, this is not financial advice. We have a disclaimer at the end of the show says, no financial advice.
Exactly. So say you want 10% of that or $10 of that $100 towards really risky assets. Well, you should put a small portion of that towards cryptocurrencies, not everything. You should put it towards, you know, startup investments, angel investments, certain equity trading that you want to do. And so it's kind of a long-winded answer for if people are interested, get into it, but don't take off this crazy large bite because it is a volatile asset. But get to know the technology, start to understand the underlying premises because it's not going anywhere. No one get too crazy on anything, but you should start to engage.
So a couple questions left. So thinking about your value add at Fiat, you help the companies with their go-to-market strategy. You obviously help them in so many ways, even with their future fundraising. But in terms of like helping them grow their company, that's got to be a huge attraction for a startup to be able to come in. I mean, it's some of what we're doing at the Growth Factory is we're adding the backyard advantage. Yeah. Well, you've got this huge infrastructure, you know, this ability to help people to really grow their company, right? And that's the toughest part for most companies is how do I get users? How do I get how do I get some revenue?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll tell you, I am one of many people, and I'm such a small part of just so many incredibly smart and talented people who make up this amazing growth consultancy that we've built called Fiat Growth, right? We've got folks like Gerard Fain, who's our managing partner, and Drew and Alex, who first created this out of nothing. But we've also been fortunate to attract former CROs, to attract former heads of paid social who ran campaigns for DoorDash and Yelp, to attract these people who really understand influencer marketing, performance marketing, affiliate partnerships, strategic partnerships, to not just advise people on, you know, strategies, but to actually become extensions of their team to run it forward. And but kind of back to like, I'm lucky here to be able to tell you about this, but there's this massive engine sitting behind me of just really smart and talented people that it just gives us such a unique advantage for both investing, but vice versa, right? So we are able to be better on the types of clients that we work with because we have an investing arm behind us. And
okay.
So we try to be really careful and diligent about the companies that we want to work with because it's people that we want to spend our time with, right? Our most precious resource. And then ultimately, using that as a way to better allocate our capital behind it. So
yeah. Okay. So two questions. I'll start with the first one. What's the long-term vision for Fiat?
Definitely. So for Fiat Growth, our consultancy is to be the premier growth shop across industries in tech, right? So fintech is our sweet spot, but we're starting to bring on e-commerce, commerce, healthcare type clients. So not just focused on fintech verticals, but expand. And Fiat Ventures has become the premier investment arm really within early stage companies in the market. And ultimately, right, like our vision is to become someone like an Andreessen or a Sequoia. Long way to go from fund one, but.
Well, you've got a team that's emerging and strong, and congratulations on your success. So final question, as we think about our audience, which there may be some investors out there, but let's think of, let's put our startup hat on, or let's assume that there's some startups out there listening that are, you know, wondering, any advice for these startups as they approach this journey? 'Cause we know it's not easy.
Yeah, big piece of advice. If you're a startup in the Sacramento region, get to know Mark, get to know Rick, because they really do have something special going on here at Growth Factory. It's amazing, not just the companies here, but the people that you pull in to teach. It really is, in my opinion, the greatest ecosystem for the region. And honestly, congrats to you guys, because it's such an amazing opportunity for Sacramento to build just a legacy of startup technology. And as you know, that doesn't happen overnight. It really takes time and time again. But these companies like the Grins and the One Finances and the Sky Slopes, they're going to generate the next wave of entrepreneurs who are going to be looking for programs like this. So, you know, I hope to look back here in 10 years when you're on cohort number, you know, 12, 13, 14 and on fund number 5 and to say that I was grateful to be a part of it from the start.
Thank you very much. We are lucky to have you back in town. It's so cool to see what you're doing, but Local Boy Makes Good. It's a great feeling for me as a longtime Sacramento guy. Anyway, Marcos, thank you for what you're doing for us here at the Growth Factory, and thanks for coming on the show today.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure, and I can't wait to see all the amazing things that come out of it.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Welcome back to the Mark Haney Show. Getting a little bit of motivation from Marcos Fernandez with Fiat Ventures. And he, you know, when a venture capitalist begins to give you money, it makes an impact, right? It makes an impact. But when he or she makes the investment plus comes around and gives you the help in building your company, that's much more of an impact. These are the kind of things that I guess that we live for as entrepreneurs, and we live for those opportunities, but those opportunities don't come by accident, right? Marcos doesn't invest into you because you have a business. He invests into you because he believes that you're making an impact and that you're going to make an enormous impact on the world. And so he invests his time, his talent, his treasure, and he helps you to take your business from point A to point B, hopefully to have a great return for everybody. And that's what venture capital is. That's what venture capitalists do. That's what we're doing at the Growth Factory. And we are, you know, looking for early stage companies that really are in the process of figuring out a way to change the world. They're very early stage companies. We get in, we roll up our sleeves, work alongside you in our startup accelerator, and we make an investment into your financial investment into your company, and we help accelerate you to that next milestone so that you can attract follow-on investment like what you might get from Marcos Fernandez or even a venture capital firm like Moneta, Impact, or one from outside of the region. But Marcos gives me a gift in the middle of the show, and I touched on this at the beginning, the different things that we do that are different, that are unique. People come on the show all the time, and many times I don't get a gift. And this one was personalized. It was a bottle of tequila, some rare tequila that I have never even tasted before. But he had heard the rumor that my friends call me Margarita Mark when I go to Cabo. And so it was specially picked out for me. It took some creativity to do that. And I guess that's what I would challenge all of us to do is, as we think about building our businesses, we think about getting employees to join our effort, we think about all the different stakeholders associated with our business and our life, and I think we ask ourselves the question, am I doing the things necessary to get noticed and to make an impact? Am I doing something so special that it creates a memory, right? I'm going to remember that bottle of tequila for a long time. It's sitting up on my shelf in a place of prominence now. And next time I break open a bottle of tequila, I'm going to look at the bottom of there, and there's a little note on there where it came from. It came from Marcos Fernandez. Something as simple as that makes an impact. But when we're thinking about the customer experience, is the customer experience that your customer receives when he or she utilizes your product, does it make an impact? Is it so good that you want to get on the radio and tell people about it? Is it so good, so different, where you're like, wow, I need to tell people? I think all of us, I mean, when we first launch the business, you got to get the product out there, and maybe it's, you know, not so good, but the best companies do something that's so different, so unique that they almost don't have competitors. They're so unique where people talk about them in a way that they don't talk about other people or other products. And I think you think about a company like Apple, right? It's not just another cell phone, it's the best. And once you get in to the Apple ecosystem, you want to have everything Apple. You want Right? You shot one of my mantras is shock them and lock them. So make such an impact on them that they're like, wow, I'm hooked on this Apple iPhone. Now I got to get an iPad. Now I need the watch. Now I need, you know, the whole ecosystem is a part of my world. And Apple's an example that we all know, but I see this in the startup community as well. We see this, I mean, Apple started somewhere, right? We all do, but we don't really take off until we have something special. We don't really take off until we have something really unique. And I think as a startup founder, anybody who's in small business, how do you know how to allocate your resources? I think that's a lot of how we think. What are you going to do with what you got? You hear me say this on the show occasionally. That's the big decision. How do you allocate your resources? Well, when you bet big on something that everybody's starting to love, you bet big on something that's really making an impact on the world, I mean, now it's time to go raise a heck of a lot more money so you can go big on what's working. And I think that as investors, that's what we're looking to do, is help you identify what's working so then we can help you get the follow-on investment so that you can bet big on that and you can really make an enormous impact on the world. So as you think about how you're going to approach the development of your product, the development of your relationships, figure out what you do differently, what you do that's so special that, man, people just want to be around it. People just want to utilize it. People want to be immersed in it. And then when you find it, bet big. Go all in on what you know. And the one thing about that is, if you go all in on something that you know that most people would disagree with, like a long shot, you go all in on a long shot, boom, you will have a home run like you have never seen before in your life. Go all in on what you know, and if it is an unexpected long shot, you are going to knock it out of the park, my friends. So to all you out there that are building businesses, fighting a good fight for entrepreneurship, or fighting a good fight for our freedom, our security, our way of life here in America, you know, here at Haney Biz, here at the Growth Factory, here on the Mark Haney Show, we're never above you. We're never below you. We're always by your side.
So gallant.
segment includes the personal knowledge, experiences, and opinions about angel investing by seasoned angel investors. This content is for informational purposes only and should not be considered as legal, tax, investment, or financial advice. Nothing in the segment constitutes a solicitation, recommendation, or endorsement.